Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Rock bottom is a lonely place, and sometimes taking care of someone else is the only way out. That's what Paul Tatonghi writes about in his essay, Learning Humanity from Dogs. It's read by Ethan Hawke, who directed and co-wrote the new film Blaze, about the life of singer-songwriter Blaze Foley.
I came home from work on a rainy November afternoon, more than a decade ago, to find a 20-foot U-Haul truck in my driveway, and behind it, a police car. My first thought was fast, clear, instinctive. Are we being evicted? I had lived in the little rental home in Middlebury, Vermont, with my wife for much of the previous year. It hadn't been an easy year. We fought constantly, the fights escalating into ugly confrontations, and the confrontations lasting long into the night. But that morning, I'd left the house suspecting nothing. I was certainly unprepared for the scene that I would encounter later that day. The wooden headboard of my bed bobbing through the front door, cradled in the arms of my father-in-law. "What's going on?" I asked. "What are you doing?" He didn't even look at me as he walked toward the truck. "Sir," the police officer said, suddenly very close, "we're going to need you to step away from the residence." It would be another 9 years before I stopped drinking. So, on that night, the night my wife left me, I blamed everyone and everything except myself. I fled the house with its two sad moving van, police and father-in-law combo, and went directly to the nearest bar, where I told everyone my story while downing pint after pint of tepid $2 Budweiser. I was not apologetic. I was not ashamed. I barely remember stumbling back home. What I do remember is what I found when I got there. Waiting for me at the door, hungry and bewildered, were Glasgow and Seismic, our two St. Bernard dogs. On an overturned cardboard box just inside the threshold, I found a letter. My wife explained that she couldn't take the dogs with her. She would be moving into her parents' house while she got her life back in order, and there wasn't room for 250-pound animals. Even so, she was hopeful that I would fulfill my obligations to her and to our pets as a caretaker. The dogs looked at me. I looked at them. We began our new lives together. That first night, I went upstairs to what had been our bedroom and, not knowing what else to do, I turned out the lights and lay down on the floor. The dogs followed. They lay down as well, one on each side of me. Glasgow, the 4-year-old female we had raised since she was a puppy, situated herself behind my back. Seismic, the male we had adopted from the Humane Society at Chittenden County, cuddled into the curl of my arm. He stank. Then again, I didn't smell much better. In an empty house, everything is louder. It seems like a small detail, but it was transformative. I had rented the home for nearly a year, and suddenly, it was completely foreign and disorienting. Every morning, I woke up with two giant animals nuzzling me, panting in my face, demanding to be walked. I would walk them And upon my return, I'd check the phone, hoping I had somehow missed my wife's call saying that she had changed her mind and was moving back. She never did. I tried to carry on. I bought groceries, said hello to the neighbors. I can see now that I was in shock, pretending everything would be okay. The house deteriorated. The laundry hamper overflowed. Bags of trash clustered in the kitchen. My bed was a sleeping bag. Dog hair accumulated in giant clumps in the corner of rooms and filthy patches in the rug. I was commuting an hour each way for work and, unmoored from my previous life, couldn't manage my responsibilities. I arranged for a dog sitter.
"You just moving in?"
she asked, surveying the near-empty house.
"No,"
I said, unable to tell her the truth. "Just, you know, minimalist living." One day, I had to leave earlier than usual for work. I called the dog sitter and told her I'd put the key under the mat, but she never showed. That night, I returned to find the foyer soaked with urine. The next week, I got a call at the gym. The dogs had broken out and were tearing through the trash at the deli down the street, eating chicken salad and stale baked goods. A neighbor had recognized them. I drove home, terrified that they would be taken away, that I would return to find them gone, a police car out front once again, and a trail of hairballs floating into the yard. For their part, Glasgow and Seismic were always glad to see me, always confident I would be bringing dog food or a cheese pizza, providing a walk, or giving them a bath. They believed in me, when no one else did, not even myself. I think I kept them for so long in that chaos because I couldn't bear to stop loving them, couldn't bear for them to stop loving me. But the truth was, I couldn't care for them, not in the way they needed. In May, I heard a rumor that a family outside of town was looking for two big dogs to adopt. I drove by their farm and saw a mile of white fencing, a neat and tidy flower bed, a freshly painted mailbox. I kept their phone number in my wallet for a week before I called it. It was another week before I didn't hang up when someone answered. The family and I arranged to meet on a warm summer evening in June. I put the dogs in my black Chevy Blazer, along with their chew toys, dog beds, and food dishes. Glasgow, as always, was excited to get in the car. She loved to sit in the passenger seat. I'd crack the window for her, and she would press her nose into the small open space and start drooling, leaving ropes of dried saliva along the glass. That day, I reached over and scratched her ears. I was crying as I drove, crying as we pulled into the parking lot of the Grand Union. The new family was there, in their Ford F-250 pickup. A man got out and walked toward me. I opened the back hatch of the Blazer. "These are the dogs," he said. I nodded. "Please take good care of them," I said, my voice cracking. Losing my wife had been sudden, a blow that struck with immediacy and power. The loss of the dogs, however, had an event horizon. I approached it gradually, and then I was beyond it, the pressure of time drawing me inescapably forward and down. On that evening at the Grand Union, I remember shepherding Seismic, who didn't hesitate, into the back of the other truck. Glasgow took more coaxing. Her hips had become bulky and she had started moving more slowly. I think that she understood at least some part of what was going on. Finally, they were both in the other vehicle. I hugged them, inhaling their scent, holding Glasgow especially close one last time. I left Vermont when the divorce was complete. There was nothing to move, just myself. I thought everything would be different when I got out of that house, when the legal issues were settled, when I had a new job, when I stopped expecting my former wife to call. I didn't drive by the farm after I surrendered Seismic in Glasgow. I didn't visit. What if they thought I was there to take them home? It was not until I got sober and had children of my own that I felt again that awesome responsibility. The complete trust that another being places in you. The faith that you will bring the pizza and take the walks and provide the warm baths. That you will be the one who guides, who tends, who listens. Glasgow and Seismic are dead now. They would be twice the usual lifespan or more of a St. Bernard. But they were, in a way, my first children. They taught me how to be human, or how to be a better human, to put someone else's needs before my own. Or maybe it was my first wife who taught me this when she decided to leave me with two dogs and an empty house. Not long ago, as I sat alone at home one night, my daughter cried out in her bedroom. She was having a nightmare. I went up, but by the time I reached her, she'd fallen back asleep. I lay down next to her anyway, in her small bed, and kissed the back of her head, brushed the hair out of her face. Then I said a small prayer of thanks and gratitude for this role, for this opportunity to care.
Ethan Hawke, reading Paul's Tatonghi's essay, Learning Humanity from Dogs. We'll hear how Paul's is doing now after the break. It's been 14 years since Paul's Tatonghi's first wife left him and since he became the sole caretaker of Glasgow and Seismic. He's since remarried and has two children. But until about 6 years ago, he was still drinking.
Everybody who gets sober has a moment when the light kind of goes on. For me, it was my son. At the age of 2.5, he saw me one morning, early in the morning, sick in the bathroom. And he said, you know, what's wrong with Papa? And he asked my wife that. And I heard it, you know. And that moment for me was incredibly powerful because I could suddenly ask that question myself. What is wrong with you? It didn't have any judgment along with it. Looking back on it now, I wish that I could have done many things differently. I wish that I had been sober. I think every alcoholic understands that they lost a lot of things because of their alcoholism. And I wish I hadn't lost those things. On the other hand, if I hadn't lost them, I would have never made it to the point that I'm at. I wouldn't have hit the bottom that I hit. And so I'm really grateful for that.
And Paul says that Glasgow and Seismic were part of the reason he was able to push through.
They were there for me when there was just nobody else. You know, that's what dogs give you, is just pure, unconditional love. And I needed it so desperately at that moment.
These days, he has a much more stable life.
Well, now I live in Portland, Oregon. My children are twins, boy-girl twins. They're 8.5 years old, so they're getting giant. I teach at Lewis and Clark College. I teach creative writing. I work in sobriety as much as I can, and my life is amazing. Like, my life is amazing.
But he does sometimes think about those years that he spent in Vermont.
You have your ghosts, obviously, when things unravel, and I never got to, you know, say goodbye to anyone from that period of my life. I mean, that remains difficult. But on the other hand, you know, I got what I deserved. So, yeah, I don't have anything else to say, really.
That's Paul Statonghi. He's author of several books, including Dog Gone, Evel Knievel Days, and Red Weather. We've got more after the break. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
You know, for me, this essay is a bit of a meditation on the meaning of selflessness or selfishness. And I feel like recognizing your limitations, in this case, is a selfless act. If it were up to him, he would love to have the companionship of the dogs. But it was at the dogs' expense. They were living like wild animals and rampaging down the street. And to be able to understand about yourself that you have to get your own house in order before you can properly care for others, I thought it was a painful moment, but an incredibly honest one, and one where he's honest with himself and his own limitations.
And here's Ethan Hawke.
I chose this story for the simple reason of how much I love dogs. When I was a teenager, I really hated going to church. And my mother said I could skip church if I would do something else on Sunday mornings for someone else. So I started working at the ASPCA and taking care of the dogs. And it's just one of the best things I could have done. It was one of the happiest times I had as a teenager, taking care of these dogs and cleaning their kennels. And I've just been in love with dogs ever since. I love animals, as we all do, and this story moved me.
Thanks again to Ethan for reading this week's essay. He directed, co-wrote, and produced the new film Blaze, which is in select theaters now. Next week, Giancarlo Esposito from Better Call Saul.
When someone goes to the trouble of trying to contact 16 judges, there's usually an important issue at stake. But I was a sorry excuse for a judge that day, and I was in no shape to do anyone a good deed.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.